if one can study the whole unabridged Mahabharata, one
Hmm.
will notice the kind of the women who were given the platform by Vedavyasa, right? Each
Right.
woman is so unique and very unapologetically herself. In the critical edition of Mahabharata, it's not shown that Draupadi rejected Karna for being a Sutaputra. And I'll tell you how it doesn't make any logic, because Suta doesn't mean a charioteer.
Hello, Sai Swarupa ma'am. Welcome on the show. So firstly, let me just, start this podcast with saying that your books are phenomenal. Avishi and Rukmini, I read these two books recently, and Avishi I finished in like 2 days and Rukmini took me just 5 hours. So this was like a really amazing read, completely page turner reads.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Feel so glad to hear that.
Ma'am, like before we start this podcast and we start talking about the whole conversation around Avishi, which is a queen, Vishpala, if I'm not wrong, from Rigveda,
yeah.
And about Rukmini as well. I just wanted to ask you, like all the books that you have written around like 5 books, out of which 4 are books that in a way, talks about Krishna. It is about women that Krishna had in his life. So how did this, journey started? Where did this start? And do you do you have some kind of, bhakti for Lord Krishna?
Yes, coming to your question, I think my writing career or the phase of writing in my life started because of Lord Krishna.
Wow.
Yeah. To give a bit of a background, I grew up with these stories from the Ramayana, Mahabharata and the Puranas, and I'm the first in my generation of cousins, so whenever there used to be a family reunion for some festival or anything like that, I used to be the storyteller for the whole bunch. And that continued till academics became more and more stringent and dominant part of our life. Then the reunions and all did not used to happen they used to. And the storyteller within me, she was still there looking for the next opportunity to tell the story within her.
Right.
And then in my early college, I had a Muslim friend who just innocently asked me, why is Krishna such a big deal to you guys? I mean, of all the gods that you have, you guys seem to love him so much and he has so many wives, and how can you love such a guy and all that? Then I told her the story of Narakasuravadha. And that is... I just told her in summary that, there was this asura called Naraka, and he abducted so many women, 16,000 as per the Bhagavatam, and he held them against their will, and he did a bunch of other horrible things, and finally Krishna had to go kill him. And then these women, they were abducted from their families, they had nowhere to go, and Krishna wanted them to have wanted them to get back to mainstream life, which is why he married them, and which is why he has so many, wives. And this part especially makes him, really, really much more dearer than, the other gods, because he feels where he's not, even if he had not married the women, he would have just got all the credit and all, all the hero's worship for killing the asura. This is something which he did beyond, beyond a normal victor would do, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. So the whole conversation, it just stuck with me. And the imaginative part of me started reimagining the whole story from the perspective of one of those women. And that's how Abhaya was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's she's an imaginary fictional character who I sent to the times of Mahabharata.
Yeah.
And even then, I didn't realize that I had a book in me. She used to be just a part of this imagination, the side imagination world that a lot of us single kids have these imaginary friends and all
Right,
that,
right.
right? So she used to be a part of that world for me. And I think instead of leaving when we grow up, she also grew with me. Then a couple of years down the line, a couple of Hindu girls asked me the same question that Razia asked me. And I was like, okay, something is actually wrong here. We are losing the knowledge. We are knowledge can be got from books, but we are losing the connect and nuance that is supposed to be had, along with just the knowledge part of
Yeah.
it. And that made me try writing the story. And in
Yeah.
the process of researching for Abhayah, right, the story was set in Bhagavatam. But when we try to reimagine it in from a historical sense, Mahabharata becomes a very important. So we have to set it somewhere in the Mahabharata timeline.
Right.
So because India is such a vast country, Kamarupa, which is the place of Narakasura or Bhauma, as I called him in the book, is Assam. Krishna is in Dwaraka. So what brings Krishna, somebody from Gujarat to all the way to Assam? Something big had to be happening. And so I set it in the backdrop of Rajasuya, the run up to the Rajasuya, that's parallelly happening
Yeah.
in the Pandava side. So that was exciting. So that in turn brought a lot of books, lot more stories to be explored. That's how Mauri happened, which is like
Right.
a sequel to Abhayah. And even for Draupadi and Rukmini, I think Abhayah gave that strong research foundation.
So,
I think I still have a couple more books around Mahabharata, but I, decided to take a small break from the whole zone.
Right. But then, you have chosen such a great storyline because when we read your books, so apart from Avishi, all the other books, I think so they crisscross somewhere in their timelines, and that is so beautiful. And that is the best part about reading your books, because you get to see, okay, this character sees Lord Krishna in this way, and the other character sees Lord Krishna in this way, and then it crisscrosses somewhere in the towards the end, and which is so beautiful.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. It's my aim, to let a whole world unfold to the reader. I want the reader to be a part of the Krishna Pandava family rather than some stranger reading a story. I would
Correct.
love for the reader to become a part and parcel of that whole beautiful family dynamics.
But then how do you define Lord Krishna? Because when we look at the whole Hindu mythology, for my mythology or history, like whatever the audience chooses to talk about it. But then when we look at it, there are two main characters. Like one is Lord Ram and the other one is Lord Krishna, and both have very distinct qualities. Lord Ram, Maryada Purushottam, then there's Lord Krishna, very flamboyant, very talkative in a way. So he has his own way. How do you define him? And why I ask is this, because all your books talk about him in some manner. And there have been a lot of misconceptions also about his choices. So I really want you to get into this topic.
Yes. So between Rama and Krishna, again, I'm not that much of an expert on Ramayana. Mahabharata is more of my comfort area, but from my limited knowledge, we come to the theory of avataras. Right. And this I am quoting from a book called Krishna, A Study in the Theory of Avataras. The author is Bhagwan Das, Dr. Bhagwan Das ji. It's published by Bhartiya Vidya Bhavan. I don't know whether copies are in print because it's a very old book. But he had a very interesting observation of how to classify the avataras. Now we go beyond just the dashavatara concept. There are many more avataras. There are people who give the world new ideas. right? And you know, that itself sets a new school of thought. So they give the world knowledge. Basically, they are for the brain of the world. They are consciousness of the world.
Yeah.
Like Kapila, you know, he gave the Sankhya school of thought, Kapila Maharshi. And Vyasa, you know, the whole corpus that he gave, you know, that's one degree of avatara. The other degree tries to put it into action.
Right.
The next degree. So our Parashurama, Rama, they come and they, you know, they just don't tell about dharma, but they try to put it into action. And Krishna is, you know, somebody who does all both these, and he remains somewhat independent of, you know, the consequences. So I'm not saying ki, you know, of course, you know, after that there was the curse of Gandhari, you know, I'm not saying that he's above that.
Yeah.
But he sees himself as a part of this world. He's not disowning the world.
Right.
But he's also independent of this world. Whereas Rama is not. Rama is still bound by the, you know, like you said, Maryada Purushottam. He is bound by the laws he himself has set.
Yeah.
Right. Krishna is still in the world, but he is free.
Hmm.
So it's not like, again, I want to quote a very beautiful comparison done by Oshoji here between Krishna and Buddha. So Buddha negated. So again, I'm not an expert on Buddhism. So this is from what I read. Buddha negated, you know, not this world. So not this body, not my mind, you know. So the nothingness here, you know, he went inward. But Krishna is like expanded.
Yeah.
Yes, I am this body. I am this, you know. I am all these people of Gokul. I am all these people of India.
Yeah.
You know, I am the Pandavas. I am the Kauravas. That's the whole concept behind the Vishwarupa, right? Where Arjuna.
Exactly, yes.
You know. So Krishna's ego, I'm not saying ego as arrogance or anything like that, but Krishna's notion of self is everything.
Hmm.
So whatever, right, wrong, anything that happens, he knows that he is going to be the object of it. So, you know, the level of freedom is something else.
Yeah. And like there was this one scene in Rukmini where Lord Krishna is, he's running away with Rukmini and Rukma is chasing them. And there's this one line which Krishna says to Rukmini, which is, a person who cannot even think of himself, like something on this, I'm obviously paraphrasing.
Yes.
So that actually defines that he sees himself and everyone around him. So he's like, okay, I don't care because they are doing what they are doing because I have set it that way.
Exactly. See, that's the thing. I'm also practicing Sri Vidya, which is a way of worshipping Mother Goddess. And you know, we have the concept of chakras. You know, it's there in a lot of schools, yoga, everything. But Krishna is the Lord of Anahata Chakra. You know, that's in the heart. And Anahata Chakra stands for unconditional love.
Wow.
So at a level, Rukmini, who loves him, is dear to him. As well as Rukma, who hates him, is also dear to him.
Yeah.
The way he deals with both may be different, but, you know, somewhere he holds them both together.
Right. And also, like, as you mentioned that Anahita Chakra, right? So it is the chakra of unconditional love. And what I have noticed this is that whenever, like, you know, someone prays to Lord Krishna, is into, you know, Krishna bhakti, the bhakti, it comes from eternal love. It comes from that unconditional love. There is no, like, for example, for other gods, there might be some conditions. Okay, if I pray to you, you give me this. But for Lord Krishna, a lot of people have just love. And
yes. That's right. And this is not to put the other gods down, because, you know, the nature of human evolution that happens, the spiritual evolution that happens with association of each god, it has a, you know, particular function. Like, say, the Muladhara Chakra is associated with Lord Ganesha. And he better have good conditions, because he's the one who gives you that progress, and that progress has to be given to somebody who deserves it. So there he cannot be unconditional, you know.
Yeah, makes sense. So let me ask you this. When we look at all the Indian mythological stories, when we look at the religion Hinduism, a lot of people have said that it is a very patriarchal religion, and the whole stories always talk about the men and the heroes, and then you choose to write about the sheroes, the female character. So was this a conscious decision, or like this was just some, you know, divine calling?
Part of both, okay. But not because, you know, I feel I disagree with the, you know, popular notion that Mahabharata, Ramayana, the whole Itihasa corpus is male driven or patriarchal or anything like that. But what happens here, like, in fact, if you observe, if one can study the whole unabridged Mahabharata, one will notice the kind of the women who were given the platform by Veda Vyasa, right? Each woman is so unique and very unapologetically herself, you know, right from Shakuntala, you know, her, the way she wed and, you know, the way she asserted herself and, you know, got her son to be the king, you know, that's something, you know, to take the risk with the man you love, and that's something. Take the case of Savitri, that's totally something else. And, you know, the whole Kuru women, Kunti, Draupadi, Gandhari, nobody is weak here. So, and also there's one scholar in Telugu who said that this, ki Kavi Hridayam is Stri Hridayam. Any rishi who is composing, he has to have a feminine heart to, for that, you know, for that work to stand the test of time.
Oh, wow. That is so beautiful.
Yes. So this patriarchal male-driven story thing, how it happened is because of the retellings. So the retellings, they had to condense the story. And in condensing the story, somehow the focus became very action-oriented and a war-oriented, this one. So that cut down the stage time given to the female you know, feminine voice, basically. So that's the reason why a lot of people feel that, okay, they are very patriarchal. Okay, you know, Yudhishthira, he staked Draupadi, so such a patriarchal, this one. But, you know, if you read the Mahabharata, you'll understand that it's Draupadi who came and saved Yudhishthira and his brothers from becoming slaves. Like, you know, she argued, though she was, you know, she had to go through quite an ordeal, but she argued alone in the court, built dissent, you know, and finally convinced Dhritarashtra to set her husbands free and get the whole game annulled. That's the power of Draupadi. You know, in a way, it's the perspective. You know, Vyasa makes her look like the heroine of that scene, the shiro of that scene, as you said. You know, and so, a lot of people look at her as a victim. You know, she's not a victim. Of course, she had to pass through a very tough time, but she's the shiro. Ultimately, she's the shiro of that scene.
But then Draupadi has this other side as well. And I am at a point now where I don't know if this is the truth or this has been, you know, popularized by the retellings, which is Draupadi rejecting Karna in her Swayamvara.
So, okay. So I'll have to tell about the process of how the critical edition of Mahabharata came to be. So when there's an institute called Bhandarkar Oriental Research Institute in Pune. So there a scholar named Vishnu Sitaram Sukthankar. I hope I'm remembering the name right. It's V.S. Sukthankar. He's popular that way. So he put together a team of 30 Sanskrit pundits. And they collected manuscripts of Mahabharata from various mathas, ashramas, gurukuls, institutions, you know, in whatever form it was preserved. They went through each, and there were around 1,000 recensions.
Wow.
Yes. So they went through each of the, you know, recension, and each recension will have a family, right? Some gurukula in Kashi has this particular edition, and students from that school, or they would have started some school in South. So this edition, this recension would have come. So they traced this family tree of the whole. So that way, any aberrations or any additions, they they found out, and they finally arrived upon something which is common to all editions.
Yeah.
So that becomes the critical edition.
Correct.
So in the critical edition of Mahabharata, it's not shown that Draupadi rejected Karna for being a Sutaputra. And I'll tell you how it doesn't make any logic, because Suta doesn't mean a charioteer.
Okay.
Suta is a, aristocratic community. There, the father, it's a mixed caste of Brahmana and Kshatriya.
Okay.
So if a Brahmana, like a Rishi, marries a princess, she will go live in his ashram. Her sons will also become Rishis. There's no controversy here. But if a Kshatriya father marries a Brahman woman, right? And there is, the exposure for that woman is too harsh in a Kshatriya world. You know, she would have grown up with knowledge, studying, teaching.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're thrown into world of politics and intrigues. You know, that's kind of harsh. So for the children of these two, right, there were some functions set, reserved.
Okay.
So that basically sought to combine the abilities of both. So charioteer is not a low, the sarathi is not a low function. It's because I think in 21st century, I think we equate charioteer to be a driver. And say, idhar jao, udhar jao. Charioteer is not that. So he basically knows the strengths and weaknesses of the warrior. And he has certain rights about how, how long to continue that particular battle or whether to cut it and go.
Right.
And readying the chariot for the, with the weapons for the next day's war. So planning the whole strategy with who you will fight, who, Krishna used to do that for Arjuna.
Right.
So the respective charioteers used to do it for, for their respective rathis.
Right.
So that way, charioteer is like, the king and minister. So the warrior and the charioteer.
So half of the brain, basically.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
All of the brain, maybe. Because, you don't have time to think.
Right.
Right. So, that is Sarathi was one thing. And the other very popular profession reserved for Sutas was that of storytelling.
Oh, wow.
So, any Purana is a conversation between two people you will come across.
Right,
one is Shaunaka, who is the Kulapati of Naimisha. Naimisha is the root school of, root school of all knowledge in India. So he is the Kulapati or the Chancellor of Naimisha. And the other person telling the story is Suta Mahamuni. His name is Ugrashrava, but he is called as Suta. And you will see how respectfully Shaunaka addresses Suta, and he says, Suta, please tell us the story of this. And Suta is the knowledge giver, actually, and Shaunaka is the listener.
So
there was
sense.
The class of the position of Sutas was quite exalted. They may of them were kings, and a lot of people who were present in Draupadi Swayamvara were Sutas.
Wow.
That way she should have rejected everybody,
Right.
So that is not there, basically. And Karna tried, and there is in one of the Telugu Mahabharatas, there's a very detailed description of the gap with which each warrior missed the target.
Oh, wow. It is that detailed.
Yes.
Wow.
So Karna came quite close.
Okay. Okay, that means he tried, and then because he couldn't hit the target, he was rejected.
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Firstly, I want to know, how does this queen like Vishapala come into Rig Veda? What is her origin story?
Yes. So, how I discovered the story of Vishpala is quite a story. You know, that is quite a story. As I told you about Abhaya, which recently got relaunched by Bloomsbury. In Abhaya, I had a scene where my protagonist, Abhaya, is some 6-7 year old girl. And there's a scene where her father is making her trying to make her eat lunch and trying to tell her a story. And that story, I wanted it to be centered around a warrior woman. You know, like we tell inspiring stories, you know, like we tell our kids about Jhansi Lakshmi Bai or Rudrama Devi. So that would have been the practice, except that my challenge was to find a warrior woman who existed before the times of Mahabharata. So the obvious choice was Kaikeyi was a warrior, but you can't tell Kaikeyi's story to a 6-year-old, you know, without going too deep, you know. Like for the scene, I just had 4 lines for the story. So, and then Savitri, again, it's tricky to tell about Savitri to a child. Right. And so, I mean, I resorted to Google and one of the results was a conference document from one of Israeli medical universities. I forget the name now, but that was a conference document on prosthesis. And the first chapter was basically history of prosthesis, where the very first paragraph had mentioned prosthesis. The idea of prosthesis first came from the Rig Veda.
Yeah. Where,
where so-and-so him talked about Queen Vishpala losing a leg and being fitted a prosthetic leg. That's what was given in that document. And that was mortifying at two levels to me. Firstly, I used to be very, you know, arrogant about my own knowledge, thinking I'm brought up with these stories. I should be knowing almost everything at least some level. And now, I'm coming across something I totally don't know.
Yeah.
And the second level of mortification was that I'm discovering it in an Israeli document instead of an Indian site. So I think it's, you know, it's a story that needs to be popularized and retold in a way. Then I discovered why it is not retold with that, you know, level of detail, because Rig Veda itself does not shed a lot of detail about Vishpala. So there is a hymn, a sukta dedicated to Ashwini Kumaras, and they helped a bunch of people, you know, a score of people in different ways. And Vishpala was one of them who benefited. You know, one of those people who benefited from the grace of Ashwini Kumaras. So how did she benefit? She lost a leg in a battle. That battle was called Kailas battle. And then Ashwini Kumaras gave her a metal leg. So the metal was, you know, that's something which we have to take note of, because gods can give the whole leg back. You know, a lot of blind people regaining sight and all those stories are valid in the Puranic sphere and all that. But the metal is so, you know, conspicuously mentioned. Ayas, the word is Ayas.
Okay.
Yeah. So now historians keep debating whether it is iron or copper, or, you know, that's not Iron Age, or, you know, the, you know, those kind of debates. You know, one discovery or one excavation, it will send the whole, you know, whole historical period back by another 500 years, 1000 years. So I didn't want to get stuck in the historical debate as such, which is, but, you know, just think about a warrior woman in the pre-Mahabharata times and surviving on fighting with a prosthetic leg itself is, you know, concept for us to celebrate, which is why then I set about writing the story of Vishpala. I know a scholar just, you know, when I was trying to pull all the details together, a scholar told me, like, there's not even enough material to write a short story, forget a novel. You know, how, so I had to basically recreate the whole world with this detail. There is Vishpala, there is Kailas battle, she knows how to fight. She lost a leg and she got back. She got a metal leg. She fought back.
Correct.
So that's all the detail given in the Rig Veda. So I wanted to reconstruct the Rig Vedic India. In the Rig Vedic period, there were monarchies, there were democracies, there were patrilineal structures, there were matrilineal structures.
Yeah.
So there has to be a period where both these, you know, the whole system would have been very, very nascent.
Hmm.
And even the professions were very egalitarian.
Yeah.
So no stratification. The stratification also would have been very porous. And so these were the thoughts that led to the whole world building behind Avishi.
Right, right. So, you know, this is very intriguing because of two, three things. One of which is obviously the prosthetic leg. And when I read this, I was baffled because this is like, you know, thousands of years back. And at that time, someone getting a prosthetic leg, it is unimaginable. And to any mind, like be it a Hindu mind or, you know, you might be practicing some other religion as well, but to fathom that kind of information is unbelievable. So I want to know more about this prosthetic leg. And also you have mentioned in the book as well that in those times, they were like the rishis of Naimisha, they were experimenting with the concept of marriage. So marriage was also not a concept. So I want you to talk about these two things.
So that was okay. That's just a concept which I thought would make an interesting addition to the whole story in that world building. One root concept was that a lot of Hindu philosophy, let it be philosophy, spirituality, sociology, anything, it developed on a very strong atmosphere of debate.
Yeah.
So every Purana, you have a debate. The Upanishads are all debates,
mostly. Yeah.
They're all dialogue and debate. Bhagavad Gita is a dialogue.
Right.
You know, it's not, even Arjuna took around 15, 16 chapters to go for a full surrender. You know, till then he was questioning, you know, why that, why this, what can I do? What if this is not possible? So inquiry, or, you know, we call it Chintana. Right. So that inquiry is the basis of evolution in Hinduism, whether it is scientific or spiritual or materialistic, it can be anything, but inquiry has to be there. So that's one aspect that I wanted to bring out, which is why you may find a lot of debates happening in the book. You will find Rishi 1 debating with Rishi 2. On the pros and on the cons, and nothing affects their personal relationship or anything like that. You know, they are.
It is a very open-minded debate.
Yes, it's their job to debate and you know, find this. That's the development. That's development for each of them, right? And marriage, yes, because here again, Mahabharata had given me some intriguing, very, very intriguing clues. Here, I want to quote from the place where Pandu is sad about not being able to father a child. And that's when Kunti tells him that she has a boon, but that she had a traumatic experience with it.
Yeah.
You know, trying to invoke Surya, getting a child. And
which
is why, you know, till the last moment, she withheld the information back. And now Pandu treats it as a lottery. I mean, you know, I can't, but we have a chance that we'll get the gods to give us children. Yeah. And, you know, why are you hesitating? And then Kunti puts this argument of, you know, a woman should be faithful to one partner. And, you know, if you want me to have children with the gods, then it means that I'll become unfaithful to you. And then Pandu defends the method of Niyoga.
Okay.
And says, you know, this the world was not like this with such stringent... you know, fidelity terms. You know, there used to be times where, you know, people were much more liberal and women had much more choices. And we have come from that civilization. So we need not stick to what is happening today. So there are always higher aims and we should look back to past for the inspiration. So that's how he inspires her to, you know, take the step forward.
Right.
So that sent me thinking about, you know, probably it gives a very interesting mix of, you know, society that is still contemplating on wedlock. Because even without wedlock, family is such a central thing. We cannot imagine the society without a family unit, the unit of family. I mean, today we have even LGBT community, trying to get rights to, you know, marriage and adoption and all. Yeah. So family is still central to a lot of people, right? So how would that family have originated? That would have originated with a lot of thought, debate, probably centuries of selfless rishis thinking, rethinking about the whole thing. My only regret is that the story spans for 12 years, and in 12 years I couldn't show the, you know, there was no chance that I could show the whole evolution of marriage.
Correct.
But a part of it we see.
So, and that is really interesting. And then again, we come to the point where you talk a lot about the forest of Naimisha, and you have mentioned it multiple times in the book as well, that this is the place where you come for wisdom, you come for knowledge. And I was reading this one book by Sahana Singh, if I'm not wrong. So she has written Revisiting the Educational Heritage of India. So she talks a lot about the forest universities, and I never knew this concept before reading that book and reading your book. So can you talk about these universities, and according to you, how were they, you know, segregated from the society? How did they function?
So in the Mahabharata period, that there we have quite, you know, the very sophisticated systems, you know, they were set, rules were set, and people just had to follow them. You know, there was not much of need for, you know, a lot of creativity there. So there, the forest schools used to be there so that the gurus are free to teach people from all backgrounds. And king of kingdom A will say, hey, kingdom B is my enemy, don't train his kids. You know, then the rishi can say, you know, I'm going to train everybody who's eligible. So I don't depend on you. So don't come and tell me who to teach. So that way, Sandipani Sashrama was independent that way. Drona was not independent. Drona was in all purposes an employee of Kurus. So at best, he could teach only Kurus, princes, and those princes who were deemed to be friends of Kurus. So for the same reason, he couldn't teach Ekalavya. Ekalavya belonged to Magadha. So his was a small kingdom that was belonging to Magadha, and Magadha was not a friend of Kurus. So he did not have the courage to teach Ekalavya. I mean, that boy learnt by himself because of Guru Bhakti. That's a different story. So either, but the forest ashramas, like say Naimisha, the ashrama of say, you know, Vasishtha, though he was the, you know, royal preceptor, royal guru of Ikshvakus, he wielded, a, you know, quite some power. You know, they couldn't, I don't think the Ikshvaku kings, you know, came and told Vasishtha, you can't teach these people. You know, and Bhargavas, they had independent ashramas. So that way, the rishis, they wielded a lot of autonomy. The concept of autonomous universities, I think we had, you know, we had it a lot before, you know, the term university was invented, I guess. So that way, and also being in a forest, you know, the Brahmacharya period, right? I know a lot of people understand Brahmacharya is just abstinence. But it's much more about self-sustenance. The I think Brahmacharya for me is Atmanirbhara. You know, so the princes, they are brought up in palaces, but here in the forest school, they become capable of everything. Like you are learning to camp, you are learning to hunt, you are learning to survive, you are learning to cook. So everything there. So that way, forest ashramas used to really prepare these warrior students to all kinds of hardships. So that was the whole purpose, to make them self-sufficient.
So you talk about self-sufficiency, and today when we look at Indian society, I don't think so the kids today are self-sufficient, because we have become dependent on the family, on our parents. And when we look at the Western society, there it is complete opposite. It is somewhat like our ancient roots, where they are becoming self-sufficient. So
a lot of
Even when we look at the whole debate of feminism today, it has like somewhere, you know, gone very wrong for women, where their rights have been, you know, not given to them. And it is as simple as that. And then we look at the ancient time, as you said yourself, that there the women had their rights, they had certain amount of freedom, certain amount we need. It was like complete freedom for them. So where do you think this all went wrong?
All went wrong. See, if we trace the origin of feminism, right, to the West. And we have to study the kind of patriarchy that used to exist in the West.
Yeah.
And it was horrible.
Hmm.
Like women did not have the right to have a bank account. Right, yeah. To inheritance. You know, right. A woman's inheritance used to be given to her husband.
Hmm.
So it basically...
and I think so, this Britishers changed this in India as well. When they came, they changed this certain rule that after the marriage, whatever was given to the women, it won't be transferred to her. In fact, it would be transferred to the family, to the patriarchal
kind of,
family.
You know, yeah. A lot of regressive stuff, because basically the kind of, if I can use the term, Abrahamic patriarchy, which used to exist in, say, 200 years before in the West. There was a lot of misogyny there. And understandably, feminism is going to come out very strongly against, like, suffrage.
Yeah.
Suffrage was a, you know, extreme measure. You know, had to take that extreme measure where, I know, Indian women, we may never understand the pain of suffrage because we just got our right to vote.
Right.
With the constitution. I know we have to credit our leaders where it is due.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
So here, that kind of patriarchy which came from the West, the colonial patriarchy. Yeah, this is a better term, I guess, safer term. Colonial patriarchy was really, really foreign to us.
Hmm.
But then a lot of colonialism came along with the industrial revolution. So,
right.
With this industrial revolution, it disrupted the core structure of India, right?
Hmm.
So because of that, we have certain cities which are super developed and certain areas which are super backward.
Yeah.
Certain mining, mineral rich areas which are always being exploited.
Hmm.
And a city next door which, you know, has like millions of population. So it basically disturbed the family system. The older family system was in such a way that the whole family was an enterprise.
Yeah.
Whether it was pursuing agriculture or some small scale manufacturing or art or something. So when you when you are getting a daughter-in-law into the family, you'll obviously look at her skill set.
Right.
And select a daughter-in-law with some skill set which would add to this enterprise. So it is a kind of hiring, you know, with no firing. So, yeah. Basically, it's like a marriage to a woman used to be a guarantee of her career. It's not end of her career.
Hmm.
In a way, if a woman is a singer and, you know, basically some storytelling or a stage performing family would include her.
Yeah.
And she'll start performing along with the rest of her family.
Makes sense, yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to give a very, common example. I'm not trying to give a king or royal thing as an example. But so that used to be the way of India. And now suddenly there's a factory coming and basically you may get better salaries, but then women won't be employed, which means the men would go there and women would stay at home. And, a lot of disruption happened within the family system because of industrial revolution.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So that is something which caused this rift.
Right. Because
the Vivaha concept itself, one of the key lines of Vivaha is Dharmecha, Arthecha, Kamecha, Mokshecha, Nati Charami. That's what the man utters. Okay, I'm accepting you in all my Purusharthas. You are a partner in my Dharma, in my Artha, in my finances, in my Kama, in my desires, and in my Moksha. You are a partner.
Yeah.
Yes. So that doesn't anywhere mean, okay, I'll go out and bring food and you cook.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this point in the Rukmini book, in the first 50 pages, I think so, if I'm not wrong, where she's talking with her friend and she's questioning the patriarchy of Bhishma Pitama. Yes. And that is so intriguing because Bhishma Pitama, like whenever we talk about Bhagavad Gita, whenever we talk about the Mahabharata, he's like someone whom you cannot question. He's the one who set it up, you know, at the forefront of everything. And this woman who is questioning him. So today, when we look at our, you know, whole culture, we look at the religion, somewhere we are suppressing the voices of women. And how do you think we can get back to, you know, that time where everything was free for everyone?
So, firstly, I think we should get back to studying the unabridged editions. I know it's a challenging notion. You know, it's a daunting thing to, because Mahabharata, unabridged critical edition, that too with all the editions removed, critical edition, English translation is 6,000 pages long.
Yeah, yeah.
10 volumes. Though it's beautiful. I mean, if you start reading it, there's no way you're going to leave it. Mm. So it's that beautiful. So the magic of Vedavyasa is there. But at least people who are interested, they should start reading and spreading the knowledge. I'm doing right. It in my own small way. I just hope for many more storytellers to come and dispel the myths, because there is so much that we can learn from our past. Of course, we have to move forward. You know, we have to progress in all the fields, technology, space, everywhere we have to progress.
Yeah.
But you know, not with a sense of not after being uprooted from our past. One, certainly not hating our past for things that did not exist.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, so there is a lot of misinformation that is being spread about the whole, as you said, the patriarchy or misogyny, which never existed.
Right.
No, which is a consequence of some disruption that happened, and we have to work towards removing it. That is, there's no denying that.
Hmm. But then there's this issue, like whenever I study like any part of our Indian history. So firstly, about Hinduism, it never was, you know, a certain religion. It started as a way of life, which is why we call it Sanatan Dharma. And
it's a civilization, and there are six religions within Hinduism.
Exactly. And then how do you then, you know, get to the root of everything, and how do you get to know about this vast religion?
I would say, again, I am not a religious expert also, but I would say try and reconnect with the traditional schools.
Mm.
You know, whether it's a Shankaracharya Matha or a Vaishnava Matha or, you know, Sri Vidya, or, you know, wherever your family is connected to, or if it is a calling from your heart, try and connect to a traditional guru who has.
Yeah.
So there, our traditional guru parampara always traces back till Lord Shiva.
Hmm.
So whenever there is the Guru Shloka comes as, you know, Sadashiva Samarambham, Vyasa Shankara Madhyamam, Asmadacharya Paryantam, Vande Guru Paramparam. So as Dakshinamurti, Shiva is the guru who taught a lot of rishis. They taught. And that's how you have your guru to that parampara.
Right.
So somewhere, I think there is a spiritual power pervading through that line, as well as knowledge. And that is something that is a strong foundation, which will, you know, we'll keep moving with the times and with the, you know, situations. The Desha Kala Paristhiti will always have their influence, and we have to innovate and evolve out of it. But these are the foundations that will hold us close to our roots.
Yeah.
And we won't go too far. We won't be, see, when a disruption happens and we go too far from the roots, we can never find our way back. There is always a danger of not finding a way back.
Right.
Right. So here we won't drift too far, but we'll only assimilate whatever comes as new. We'll assimilate and leave out whatever is not.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, coming towards the end of this podcast, I want to ask you, like, so Amish Tripathi, he has praised your books a lot. And he talks about Shiva. And in every book, we can see some element of Shiva there. And you are writing about then Lord Krishna. Every book has that some element of Lord Krishna. What are your future plans now? Like, are there going to be more books about the, like, you know, about Lord Krishna in a way, or about the women that he had in his life?
I would say I do have a couple of stories around Mahabharata, but maybe on the main protagonists.
That would be
a good change for me from a creative this place. It would be a great change. And also there, as you said, there are these are unsung heroes. There are unsung heroes also in the Mahabharata. But currently I'm working on a couple of non-fiction works.
Based
on the Mahabharata itself, there is a lot of knowledge, independent of the story, which I think, we should revise and go back to. In fact, I think we should have, centers of excellence focusing on the knowledge of Mahabharata, not on the story, but the knowledge of Mahabharata. There's a lot about statecraft, about policy, leadership.
Right.
There's so much to explore and assimilate that into our mainstream studies.
Because
when you have this root holding you straight, even when a tragedy strikes, we may be disturbed, but we'll not give up. So that's my belief that the pandemic struck. I think the old beliefs had a lot to hold us together, during this first two waves. And the immunity, call it the immunity, and the way community came together, trying to help out each other and all. And that's the unique, the beautifully unique face of India. Whenever there is a calamity, when things are all right, we keep fighting. But when a calamity strikes, we are united. One unique feature which I, which I hope will stay.
Right. So, ma'am, thank you so much for doing this podcast. This has been such a great and, insightful conversation. And I would request people to go buy ma'am's books and read those books, because firstly, leave everything aside, leave these things, ki mythology and everything. Just go read this book, because the story is so, beautifully written. I completed Rukmini, as I said, in 5 hours. It took me just 5 hours to read the book. And Avishi took me around one and a half days, something like that. So, and I have my copies as well here. I have, in fact, made some annotations as well in the book. And these stories need to be retold. These stories need to be conveyed to our future generations as well, because these are where the real lessons lie. So thank you so much, ma'am, for doing this episode.